Well, hello everybody. My name is Bezena Hinton and welcome to this session on Towards a Carbon Neutral Actuarial Profession. Today's presenters are Martin Fry and Alan Greenfield. And Martin has worked for 30 years in general insurance and accident compensation consulting, mainly in Australia but with a few years in Hong Kong. In 1999, he established Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries with Greg Taylor and Alan Greenfield. He's advised private and government insurers, as well as accident compensation schemes, self-insurers and state governments. His interest in this topic was sparked by Alan's request that Taylor Fry aim to achieve carbon neutrality. Alan also is a founding director of Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries and was a member of the Institute's Energy and Environment Committee from 2002 to 2009. He has about 20 years' experience in non-life insurance, actuarial consulting, interspersed with long periods of experience in life, crossing jungles in Colombia, climbing high mountains in the Andes, and paddling down the Amazon. Today's presentation is a accumulation of his experience as the director of Taylor Fry, his views on corporate ethics and sustainability, his study of the environment and climate change, and his roles on related actuarial committees. We've got an hour for this session, the same as all the other ones. So 5 minutes before the end, there's going to be a warning bell. And I encourage you, when you come forward, to speak clearly into the microphone as the session's going to be recorded. And also, please remember to fill in your feedback forms at the end of the session. And I've been told, don't fold them because the computer's scanned and it wrecks it up, even though everyone has been folding them. So I'd now like to introduce Martin and Alan and welcome them to the presentation.
Thanks, Bezena. The topic today is towards a carbon neutral actuarial profession. What I was going to do before I started was take a little survey just to see from a small sample where the balance of beliefs lies. So I'm going to ask you to vote on which of four groups you fall into. I'm going to start off with the people who firmly believe that global warming is a fallacy, and then those who think it probably is but are sceptical, those who think man-made, anthropogenic global warming is reality, and those who are firmly convinced it is. So they're the four options I'm going to offer you. So I'm going to ask you now, who puts themselves in the first group? Firmly believes that man-caused global warming is a furphy. One. Those who think it probably is but are somewhat sceptical. One. Those who think global warming is probably man-made but sceptical. And those who firmly believe. Oh, that's surprising. I expected we'd be grouped towards the middle. All right. Well, our job this afternoon is to move a couple of you. Bill, where do you put yourself in those four groups?
I missed the four groups.
Well, I'll tell you again. Complete disbelief that man-made global warming exists. Believe it probably does, but somewhat sceptical. Believe global warming is man-made, but not believe, and true believer that really does exist. Okay, we've got a majority then. Strong majority, I think. So we're preaching largely to the converted, but that's all right. What we're going to go through today is follow very much the paper because we guessed, like most people at this conference, you haven't had a chance to read all the papers. I certainly haven't read many. Take that as zero. And so we're going to actually take you through what we said in the paper. But if you're interested, you can read the details later. The paper started off with asking the question, what are we talking about? Why are we talking about it? We've called it Greenhouse Gas Accounting 101, a sort of an explanation of where the current thinking, what standards have been delivered, how things are measured and so on. Then Alan's going to talk about the Australian context, how we fit into that overall scheme. And that's kind of a background to our case study, which is what Taylor Fry has done to achieve carbon neutrality. And we're going to try and draw from our own experience how the thing might work if people wanted to achieve carbon neutrality. It's kind of a roadmap, if you want to, of what you might do. And to demonstrate, it's reasonably straightforward. It's not difficult. And then talk a little bit about costs and benefits. So straight into it. The challenge we posed at the start of our paper was we challenged the global actuarial profession to become the first carbon neutral profession on the planet. So that's the challenge we've thrown down. And we're going to tell you today what that means. First of all, you'll see in the paper a glossary and acronyms. It's a huge alphabet soup. There are acronyms flying around all over the place. They're all explained in the paper, but the important ones are the top six, the greenhouse gases, and the next group is the organisations. But the important things are the ones down the bottom. GHGs are greenhouse gases, and GWP is global warming potential. And CO2E are carbon dioxide equivalents. So the terminology that a lot of people use is, what is the carbon dioxide equivalent of a particular sort of emission? So these are statements that we make in the paper that we take as self-evident. That the overwhelming evidence from climate scientists is that human activity does cause global warming. That the Earth would be better off without human-induced climate change, that carbon-neutral actions will reduce global carbon emissions, and that business and all of us have a responsibility to reduce those emissions. And I'll explain a little bit about those. The scientific opinion is now overwhelmingly that humans have caused recent global warming. And if you bother to read a lot of the literature, you'll find that the sceptics' opinions are generally not peer-reviewed compared with the climate scientists, who are a large body of experts where things are subjected to scientific rigour in terms of peer review. They're not widely published, they're reliant on a smattering of facts, and they're quite often from unqualified authors, and I'll talk a little bit about that later on. These are a couple of facts. They are very stark trends, one showing the global land ocean temperature index, the one here on the left, and the one on the right is the atmospheric carbon dioxide at Mauna Loa Observatory. Just as an example of the sort of arguments that we have seen from sceptics. The first one is the air temperature from land thermometers. This is all taken from a website called Lavoisier, which is one of the leading sceptical websites. It shows the trend fitted to those air temperatures between 1979 and 2010. And what the website showed was that if you took air temperature from satellites, the argument was that the air temperature from these land thermometers were biased because they were influenced by man-made activities. You know, they were close to buildings with outflow from air conditioning, and so they were giving falsely high readings. And they claimed that there was this information from satellites that was available, but scientists were ignoring it. And they showed on their website that if you fitted a trend line to those temperatures, it actually showed the whole thing flattening since about, when is that? 2002. Yeah, so for the last nearly 10 years, there hasn't been any global warming. Now, what I think one of the anti-skeptic websites did...
This one's on Wikipedia.
On Wikipedia... was to overlay the two sets of data, and you can see the numbers almost correlated almost exactly, and they've fitted three trend lines to it. One, the one in red is from a university. The one in green is from RSS, which we're trying to remember what it was. And the blue line in the middle, the fitted one, is the air temperature direct surface measurements. So, The sceptic website had just sort of artificially bent the line at 2002 and taken it to be proof that the trend lines had changed. But if you used a consistent methodology and fit a trend line to the whole time series, you got the same answer whatever measure you used. And that's the kind of argument that people find convincing unless you dig a bit deeper. Our view is that climate scientists are specialists. You know, if you've got a dental problem, you go to a dentist. If you've got an insurance liability valuation, you probably try an actuary. If you want sensationalism and beat-ups, you'll try News of the World. And so when you're thinking about climate predictions, why wouldn't you rely on the vast body of knowledge of climate scientists? And yet a lot of the people who comment on climate change don't have any background in the area. So a lot of them have got preconceived notions, and they take data like I just showed you and manipulate it. And a couple of websites there suggested about that take a number of the leading sceptic arguments and apply logic to them and show where some of the logical flaws are in them. And the one on the right, Alan particularly recommends. These are some of the statements from the IPCC, and I'll leave you to read them from yourself, but they're pretty blunt. This is the distilled wisdom of a very large group of climate scientists. The take from it all is that the overwhelming opinion among climate scientists is that global warming is real, that it's going to cause warming of about 0.2% a decade, and the most recent thinking among climate scientists is that those predictions were somewhat optimistic and that we're now looking at the more pessimistic end of their earlier projections. So moving on, no one can predict climate change precisely, and a lot of the debate is about how imprecise those projections are. What the Stern Review said was that while nobody can predict it clearly, the risks are very clear. There is a potential large risk that global warming on the scale we're talking about will be catastrophic. And Stern also went on to say that mitigation is an investment to avoid the worst outcomes. So if you think about the alternatives, mitigation makes a lot of sense. But what we say in the paper is that government actions have been very slow. I mean, you've watched the progress from the Kyoto Protocol and the various changes that the Australian government's undertaken, governments around the world have been similar, and progress has been somewhat slow. So our thesis is that governments need encouragement, and organisations can make a start. They'll be small, but they'll be as much symbolic and encouraging as anything else. And this is just a little table about a risk management approach. We thought this would appeal to the actuaries. And if you think about it in terms of risks and investment, the false positive and false negatives, the consequences of no action, if there is no such thing as anthropogenic climate change, is nil. If you spend 1% or 2%, that's what the Stern Review said we needed to spend, you get no benefit from it. So you've wasted 1% or 2% of GDP. But if there is anthropogenic climate change and you do nothing, global temperature rises between 2% and 6% within 50 to 100 years, which would be catastrophic. All the climate scientists seem to agree that the results would be catastrophic. And in the bottom right-hand corner, if you spent the money, there will be still some global temperature increases, but they will have at least been mitigated. Now, on a risk management sort of basis, that seems to suggest that you want to be somewhere towards the bottom right-hand corner. Somewhere in the bottom, it's less seriously, you're less seriously wrong if you've made an investment and wasted your money than if you do nothing and just let global temperatures increase. Now, the sort of framework we're talking about is called the GHG Protocol. It's a framework for measuring greenhouse gas emissions, and the issues are business goals, inventory, reporting, establishing a base year, scope and calculation. It sort of takes you through an order in which you do things. And so you first of all say what your goals are. You take an inventory of what your emissions are and what your embodied emissions are, all the things to do with buildings and construction and transport and your ongoing energy use, electricity and travel and so on. Establishing a base year, but they think it's important that you report on everything against a base year comparison to see how you're going. then talk about the scope of what you're going to offset, what sort of emissions you're going to offset, and then the calculation. And then there's a feedback loop where you go back and do the whole thing each year and see how you're going and report against it and see what changes need to be made. And just to talk about what those scopes are, there are three scopes described in the GHG protocol. And if you are going to take some sort of emissions measurement, the first two are compulsory. So your direct greenhouse gas emissions, you know, things like boilers and furnaces, vehicles, chemical processes, manufacturing and so on, the sort of direct emissions from doing stuff. Then there's the scope two, which is the indirect greenhouse gas emissions, and that's things like purchasing and consumption of electricity. And those two are compulsory, so you've got to account for those if you're going to undertake a GHG emissions strategy. And scope three is the voluntary one, so they're the other indirect ones, like the purchase of products and services, including flights and paper, and the embodied emissions in buildings and so on. And when Alan talks about what Taylor Fry's done, he's going to give you a little description about how our approach to that, which was pretty simplistic in the early days, probably still is, how it fitted in with those. So now I think Alan's going to talk about the Australian context and then take you on to the case study.
Okay, thanks, Martin. Okay, in the Australian context, it's a bit confusing because the government can't make up their minds, nor can the opposition. The Kyoto Protocol, the Australian government signed that a few years ago when it was Kevin Rudd's first official act, I think, when he came to power. He signed the protocol, and what that commits Australia to, so we are committed to this, is that we will increase by no more than 8% our emissions in the period, the measurement period, which is 2008 to 2012, compared to what our emissions were in 1990. It's worth pointing out that this is a lot sort of better or worse, depending on your point of view. It was allowing a lot more flexibility for the Australian country compared to most developed nations who had to reduce by 5% their emissions. So Australia battled really hard for years and years to achieve this sort of concession, and then didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol for a number of years, and finally did only a few years ago. For a long time, we talked about a CPRS, the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. It was an emissions trading scheme that was to cap the amount of emissions in Australia. An emissions trading scheme works by basically allowing a top number of emitters, so in the Australian context I think it was meant to be 1,000 sites, and allowing those sites to emit up to a certain amount of carbon, and so you give certificates to those sites that they could emit a certain number of carbon units, and then anything over that they had to either reduce or buy somebody else's bits of paper to say that they had permission to emit more. And so that it worked it's the most efficient way of reducing emissions, because those that find it more expensive to emit will buy somebody else's bits of paper. And those that find it cheaper will reduce more and sell their paper to make some more money. So that's the most efficient way. But after a number of tries in government, the Senate rejected it twice, I think, and then a third time it was headed towards Parliament. And I'm not sure what happened. I guess he lost his balls. It got deferred. And then he lost his job. After that, we've now got a national carbon offset standard. So alongside an emissions trading scheme. A lot of people, organisations are trying to do something additional to reduce emissions, and there's a scheme in place that sort of regulates or provides guidance on how you can reduce your emissions, and it not and it's, it sort of falls outside what the government does. See, if there wasn't such a thing in place, then the government might require a cap on emissions, and voluntary action might just get taken up as being a reduction to those emissions. So there's a way around all that. There was a meeting in Mexico recently. Australia gave a commitment at that, well, it was more of a statement by one of the politicians, that we would move towards a carbon price. And what's flown on from there is that we now have a framework, a committee, to develop a scheme for Australia. There's been a Garneau review, a more recent one, that has reported on it. There will be a scheme potentially starting from the middle of next year, if it's not delayed. And the idea is that there'll be a fixed price, so it's more like a tax, and that'll move to an emissions trading scheme after a period of 3 to 5 years. So that's the Australian context, if nothing changes between now and sort of mid-next year. Okay, the case study is probably a bit easier to talk about because I've been involved in it since the beginning. It seemed to me about, I suppose it started about 7 years ago, that as a company we don't ask the public to pay for our coffee, tea and biscuits or our paper supplies, and we shouldn't ask them to pay for our pollution. So it was a sort of a natural progression from there to say, well, you know, with this carbon emissions that we're causing, we need to deal with them. And in any case, it was relatively cheap to do so. Perhaps if it had been expensive, I might have had more of an argument. But when I presented the case to the board, it seemed relatively trivial, so we just went ahead to do it. Early estimates were that it would, for us to reduce and offset all of our carbon emissions would cost us less than 0.1% of revenue or less than 0.5% of profit. Okay, so at the time I hadn't heard of the greenhouse gas accounting standards or the GHG protocol, which Martin introduced. So I just thought, well, the obvious thing is we need to offset our emissions from electricity use, and we do a bit of plane travel, so we should do that. And there were a few smaller other items that we threw in because we could. They were easy, but they're sort of almost irrelevant in terms of the amount. But how it fits into the scopes 1, 2 and 3 that are defined by the greenhouse gas accounting is that we don't have any scope 1 emissions. We don't directly burn anything. We don't own any vehicles. We don't own any generation facilities. So we have no scope 1, and most companies would be like that, unless you're a mining or a manufacturing organisation. scope 2 is electricity use and nothing else, and so everybody will have that. And scope 3 are other indirect sources of emissions. So the obvious one is plane travel. The other two that we've included is taxi travel and paper use. But the ones that we haven't included are things like telecommunications uses a lot of power, and the only power that's directly included in our calculations is scope 2 electricity, where it's in our tenancy, but all of that power that Google's using or that Telstra's using that supplies us with telephone lines and internet sites, we haven't included that. There's embodied energy in everything that we use, office equipment, the building we inhabit, and so forth. Although those things are all a lot harder to estimate, and we haven't attempted to do that. Okay, so to do it, it's not very difficult. Collecting data on electricity should be very easy. It's just a matter of getting your electricity bills. It's actually a bit harder than you might imagine because we have two offices, and in each office there's our own electricity bill, and then there's the one that the landlord sends us for the common parts of the building. And they don't typically send you the electricity bill, they just send you the amount you owe them, which includes everything, including cleaning and other things. So you need to ask for those, and sometimes they're a bit stubborn, couldn't be bothered. Flights, you just need to keep track of them, so we do that through our expense system. Paper's pretty easy, we just account for that when we buy it. And taxis, well, we don't collect any information on taxis. We just assume that every time we go to get on a plane that we're probably catching a couple of taxis, one at either end. And every time we go out to dinner as a firm, there's a whole bunch of taxis there. So we estimate the number and we assume it's 50 kilometres a trip or something, and then we add 25% because it's so small it doesn't really matter. So then we have this formula for our emissions, which basically is an estimate of the number of carbon dioxide equivalent tonnes that is emitted for each of those items. So in the case of a kilowatt hour of electricity in Sydney, the assumption is that there's one and a bit tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent emitted. That figure we use from Climate Friendly, who are the company we purchase our carbon offsets from. So Melbourne's got a higher factor, I guess, because they've got those brown coal electricity generators, Loy Yang, I guess. Then emissions per flight, we have a lookup table. So if you fly Sydney to Perth, there's a lookup table that says how much you're emitting. It's worth pointing out that there are a lot of calculators on the website that calculate these sorts of things, and some of them they use different assumptions. The most important one for flights is whether you allow for the fact that burning a fossil fuel at altitude causes more global warming than it does burning it the same amount at sea level. And some of the airline calculators don't allow for the fact that burning it at altitude causes a lot more global warming than at sea level, so you get a much cheaper offset if you use their calculators. The factor's about three times as great when you burn it at altitude. Taxis, there's a factor there for the burning of the petrol, and 10.6 tonnes of carbon dioxide for every 1,000 reams of paper. So I don't think we go through 1,000 a year. So. Okay, that's our formula. Everyone would have their own. And here's what our emissions history looks like. You can see that most of it is electricity. It's the dark blue bar is about, it's more than 75% of our emissions in each year. The lighter blue is our planes, and then the grey is miscellaneous, which are paper and taxis. I've also plotted there the number of full-time equivalent staff each year, and you can see that there's obviously the more people you employ, the more electricity you use, but on this next chart you'll see that it hasn't been a proportionate increase. So this is a chart that shows the emissions divided by the number of staff. So that's our sort of emissions intensity. It sort of, for us, because we were a startup firm in 99, it comes down naturally, just because if you have a sort of an office of 100 square metres and you put two people in it and then you double to four people, then you don't use a lot more electricity, it's just a couple of computers, so your emissions intensity goes down, which is what was going on in the first 5 years, I guess. And then we were moving offices, so Melbourne moved from a service office, which was just Martin and Daniel, I guess, in a corner of a building somewhere, to a more palatial environment where they were using a lot more electricity for just the two of them. So that was the big spike in 2001. Sydney moved from a dodgy old office to a less dodgy, less old office in 2003, and that was that led to a decent reduction. We started becoming, I think, aware of all of this in 2004, and one of the guys who his name's Guy, who sort of looks after our lights when a bulb blows, just decided we didn't really need so many, so he didn't replace them. So we would go from having two fluoro tubes in every fitting to one over time because it seemed bright enough. So I think a part of that reduction over time has been awareness. And we also got, you know, convinced people to turn lights off and computers off when they went home. So we had a reduction over sort of the 4 or 5 years to 2008. And we employed a lot of people. Well, we were employing every year, but there was a sort of a spike around 2008, and I got lazy in telling everybody to... well, I was away, actually, for a few years, and I got lazy in telling people to turn lights off, and people started forgetting and getting lazy. And so I think we've had an increase in the last few years. I guess the important thing about this is just to... If you have this information, you can use it as a feedback, so you can do something about it. At Taylor Fry, we've undertaken various strategies that are sort of on the sustainable side of things. It's not only about... I mean, the first thing you want to do is reduce your footprint. So we've done that by asking people to use to turn off things when they're not using them, to use less paper. We used to reuse paper. When in the old days, people used to only print one-sided, and so we'd sort of collect all the one-sided printouts and sort of make pads out of the other side of them. we now do everything double-sided, so there's not a lot going on there. Recycle. Our building where we were didn't have pickups of paper and other recyclables as part of the tenancy, so we would pay to have that done. We try and use carbon neutral suppliers where we can, so we choose a printer for our printing needs that is a carbon neutral printer. We try to get other carbon neutral suppliers for things, so we're not brilliant at looking for them. Banking was one where we, based on the advice of our admin staff, we didn't change to a better bank initially. We were with the NAB, and Westpac seemed like a better choice from a sustainability option, but we didn't change because of the amount of work involved, which proved to be, I guess, over time a good thing, because NAB is now carbon neutral and Westpac hasn't yet gone that way. Then after doing all of that, you find you might reduce your electricity somewhat, but you can't really, you can't reduce it to zero. There's no chance of that. So what we do is offset the rest by buying certain types of offset. Now, originally we started out with tree planting. It was all the rage, I guess, about 7 or 8 years ago. There was a lot of talk about it. You can still do it. And the next slide shows why we've stopped using trees for offsets. The way all the calculators work for trees is that you work out how many tonnes of carbon dioxide you're going to emit in the next year, and let's say it's 100, and then you plant enough trees in that year to offset the 100 tonnes over the lifetime of the trees. So in the first year that you plant those trees, you might only offset a couple of kilograms of carbon dioxide, so you're in debt by your 100 tonnes to the environment. And it's only over time that carbon dioxide is sequestered in those trees. But next year you've emitted another 100 tonnes, and you're nowhere near caught up. So basically, for 50 years or so, you're always going to be in debt, and you're just pumping more and more, or you're causing the pumping of more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So you're not really achieving much in the short or medium term, or even the long term with trees. So the alternative is to plant a whole heap more trees than you really need up front for that first year of emissions, so that you build up a forest that after a while is actually you catch up a lot quicker. So that's the first one, just shows where you're in debt the whole time. The second one costs more, and you get you suck up your carbon dioxide sooner. Okay, so what we decided is we'll offset with renewable energy type projects. These projects are projects that wouldn't occur unless there was the additional funding from organisations or individuals buying offsets. So, for example, if you can burn coal and produce electricity at 5 cents a kilowatt hour, and it costs you 15 cents a kilowatt hour to produce electricity from a wind farm, then nobody's going to do it purely on the economic basis. But if you pay that wind farm 10 cents a kilowatt hour, they'll go ahead and do it. So carbon offsets for renewable energy schemes are those offsets that cause a renewable energy project to come into being. So this is just a list of the amounts of offsets we've purchased over the years since we started. The first two lines, we do all this with Climate Friendly, which at the time wasn't owned by Macquarie Bank. Anyway, I think they're now owned 50% by Macquarie. They initially started out where you'd estimate how many tonnes you were going to emit in the first year, or in a year, and you'd pay for those up front, and then you'd do a reconciliation at the end of the year. And that just doubled the amount of work for everybody. So these days we just do it once at the end of the year. So the first two related to the 2006 year, and it turned out that we spent about $7,500. The next year came along, and the price of offsets was a lot lower than it had been in the first 2 years. And I think our admin staff said to me, "So how much do you want to spend this year?" I said, "Well, the board's used to spending $7,500. Let's just keep it at $7,500. Let's not take the windfall gain. We'll just keep spending $7,500. So we did that each year since, even though we haven't needed to offset the emissions in those years. Which means that what we're doing is we're aiming to offset all of our emissions prior to going carbon neutral. So the light blue, well, the purple is the emissions that I showed you earlier. The light blue is what we've purchased, and the dark blue is a sort of a transfer of the excess from the last 3 years into earlier years. We also have planted those 3,700 trees, which are growing somewhere, those that are still alive, and sequestering some additional carbon. And also, I think part of 2005, we purchased green electricity in the Melbourne office, so we're probably slightly we've probably offset more emissions than are shown here. Okay, what are the costs and benefits of doing all this? The first bullet, the initial assessment may be a significant cost. I guess you need to put that in there as a warning. I don't think it really cost us much. I mean, it cost some of our admin staff some extra work, and they don't like doing anything more than they have to. One of them is my sister, so I cop it endlessly. But really, it doesn't take a lot to to collate a few electricity bills. And if you, you do this in the if this or in a consulting firm, there's always a period where you've got some analysts not doing something, so you can hold it over and say, look, when you've got some time, put these in a spreadsheet for us. And it was things like setting up a spreadsheet to put every flight into that we take and things like that. So there's an ongoing cost of recording things. But if for a bigger company, obviously there's more involved, but then again, as a percentage of their total business, it's still going to be tiny. The cost of offsetting, we spend the $7,500 a year, and we're sort of about 40 staff, so it's a bit less than $200 per person per annum. But the $7,500 is more than we need to spend, so maybe it's only $150 that we would actually need to spend. And it's less than 0.2% of wages. So I think the costs are relatively trivial. Nobody at our firm notices that they're not getting their an additional 0.1% of, a quarter of a percent of their profit share. And the benefits that flow, I guess, staff like the fact that they work in a company that cares about what they're doing, that is aiming to be an ethical company. They like the fact that we are carbon neutral. So, we get asked by it when people interview us, when we interview with people. So I think it's the sorts of benefits are those that flow to operating in a ethical manner. We have picked up one client because of it, but we didn't do it for that reason. But, there are, I guess, other benefits. Okay, so at the beginning of this, we started out with a challenge. Based on the massive turnout here today, I don't suspect this challenge is going to go too far straight immediately following this presentation. Maybe we can send the paper to some presidents of various associations around the world. We'll see how we go. My idea was that governments are taking their time about this. It's worse in Australia, I think, than overseas. So there are plenty of governments overseas that are doing things. But any assistance we can give governments, I think, is good. If there are more carbon neutral organisations and companies, then it'll be easier for governments to go ahead and do make the hard decisions. So the idea is that we would become the first profession globally to be carbon neutral. We'd need to find somebody who'd be willing to administer it. I guess the International Actuarial Association might be the place to start. We'd need to define some sort of boundaries of the profession so that we could say what was whether we were carbon neutral or not by who was in and who wasn't. So my idea was, something like 90% of actuaries and you do it, through all the insurance companies and, say, consulting firms. And you'd sort of maybe exclude the one-man operators as being too difficult to collate all of that. And you'd also maybe want to include the universities and the associations themselves. What would the impact be? Well, I guesstimated there are 100,000 actuaries and actuarial students around the world. I don't know where that number came from. I originally started writing this paper for the convention 2 years ago, but didn't finish it in time. The 100,000 actuaries and students, as I said, I don't know where it comes from, but I heard 55,000 actuaries the other day in Cecil Bykirk's presentation, so I guess 100,000 seems reasonable. Our emissions are about 7 tonnes per FTE per annum, so there's the 700,000 tonnes. But I noticed in, I think in the Deloitte's, on the Deloitte's website, that their emissions are about 4 or 4.5 And I think I saw on one of the other big firms, maybe it's KPMG or PwC, that theirs was less than 4 tonnes per person. So we're talking about something less than 1 million tonnes of carbon dioxide, which is a negligible practical impact. It's 0.002% of global emissions. But I guess it would have a real impact on mines if you had professions starting to go carbon neutral. And I think the fact that what we're looking at here is a sort of a risk, approach to risk management. This is a risk to the globe. If we don't do something about it, we have a risk of events that we can't control and that could be extremely poor outcomes for a large portion of the world. Versus taking some action now, which is relatively small cost. So I think if the actuarial profession decided to do something, it would show, look, we're the masters of risk, and we think that we should be doing something about this. Okay, so what's the current status? How close are we at the moment to carbon neutrality? Well, there's the Institute of Actuaries of Australia makes all its conferences carbon neutral. Other associations are doing some things, not a lot. There are already at least 3 actuarial consulting firms that are essentially carbon neutral in Australia. So that's ourselves, PwC and KPMG. And others have statements that they're making progress towards reducing emissions. HSBC, Swiss Re, NAB are all carbon neutral financial services companies. And IAG aims to be carbon neutral from next year. And I suspect university departments would be happy to, and universities would be happy to join. I haven't done any research on those. Okay, so I thought we should end with a secondary challenge, and that is to challenge all the other professions to beat us to it. So that ends our presentation, and we'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Alan and Martin. I think that's a great challenge to the profession, and I'm interested in your comments on this and how we're going to take this forward. So if anyone would like to come forward with a question or a comment, please come up to the microphone now. Yep, Eddie.
Eddie Fabrizio. One thing you said there is that it only cost you 0.2 or 0.25% of it. What would you have done if it was going to increase your cost by 10%? Would you have done the same thing? And what considerations would you take in respect to your competitors in the market who may not be doing that and therefore get a price advantage out of it? Would your theories be completely different? Would you have gone a different way?
I'll have a go at answering that because I've been thinking since we wrote the paper about what Stern says in his paper. He's... I don't know if any of you have read it. It's a very, very comprehensive and large document and very well put together and thought out. He's thought of an awful lot of possibilities and he's put a lot of sensitivities around it. And his view is that the cost globally should be about 1% to 2% of GDP. So if the average GDP in Australia is about of the order of $50,000, we're talking about $500 to $1,000 per person in Australia. That's across the whole population. Of making real reductions in carbon emissions. So your question is hypothetical, and from what Stern is saying, it's order of magnitude too big. So it's at the worst, it's 1% or 2% of GDP, and the current version is that's likely to be towards the upper end of that range. But those numbers from Stern are still considerably higher than the numbers from Taylor Fry. So, he's talking about $500 to $1,000 per person in Australia. We, as Alan's just said, we spend $10,000 across 40 people of Taylor Fry. It's $250 per person. That's only their emissions while they're working at Taylor Fry. So I think it would have been a hell of a lot more difficult decision if we'd been talking numbers like 10%. I suspect we would have that the board would have said that that's a significant part of our profit margin. We just couldn't afford to do that, and we'd have to reduce rather than buy offsets, for example. We'd have to do something different, and that would have a material impact on your competitiveness. You couldn't operate efficiently. You'd have to sacrifice somewhere, and I don't think we would have done it if it had been that expensive. But all my point is, the information seems to be that the best estimates in the world are that it ain't going to be that expensive. That it's 1% or 2% of GDP, and
I suppose my question is, the 1% is fine. That's an average. Some industries are going to cost a lot more. I mean, financial services, it is only going to be the 0.25%. But if you think about a manufacturing business, it could be 10%. And if you think about a manufacturing business who wants to go carbon neutral, and they've got competitors, whether local competitors or international competitors, and they go, yes, we want to be carbon neutral, but it's going to cost us 10%, I think it's causes a lot more issues than something we're in a financial services industry where it's very different.
Except that when we purchase the manufacturers, they become our indirect emissions. They don't have to offset all of their emissions. They only have to offset the bits that they don't transfer to somebody else in products. So we have a responsibility, and it's taken up in those indirect emissions. So the average is there is some smearing, there is some spreading out of things like manufacturing.
And that's why you need a scheme from the government, is to deal with the big organisations that can't afford to just go and do it by themselves. So you couldn't expect Woolworths to do it and Coles to sit around and offer everything 10% cheaper or something. So that's why you need a scheme, or you need agreement. You know, whether it's an oligopoly, you could have them all agree to do it. But I think it's a lot more fear around those things than needs to be. I heard recently that, you know, Europe's had an emissions trading scheme for a number of years now, and they didn't lose any of their steelworks. Right? I mean, Germany produces a lot of steel, and they didn't all disappear overnight and say, oh, it's too expensive here, we'll go and operate in Indonesia. Right? I mean, I think there's too much fear-mongering, because there are lobby interests that just want to keep their costs low and don't want to do something about it. But there are plenty of large organisations that are just happy to get on with doing it. They just need the framework there so they know what the price is, and they know that they won't be disadvantaged competitively. But, you know, China's doing plenty of work in reducing its impact. And Australia should be leading the world. We're going to lose opportunities rather than cost us money. We're going to lose plenty of opportunities to be leaders of all sorts of new green tech and clean tech industries, which could employ all the people that get lose jobs out of coal. Instead, we're going to be sitting around selling coal until the rest of the world doesn't want to buy it, and we'll have lost the chances. I mean,
yep.
Hi, Tony Snowman. Martin, as you correctly assumed, I haven't read the paper, so I just caught some of the figures, and I wasn't sure if I got them correct, because I think early on in the paper you said that emissions, well, if nothing was done, temperature would rise by about 0.2% per decade.
It's meant to be
0.2 degrees.
You said percent.
Okay, 0.2 degrees per decade. But then in your little risk analysis chart, you said, over 50 to 100 years, temperatures would go up 2 to 6 degrees. So 10 decades is times 0.2 is 2 degrees. So is this just some more fear-mongering for us skeptics? And the other question is just, what do you guys think of the carbon tax that's being proposed by the government now in terms of a solution?
The IPCC, who produces the reports, the review of what the status of climate change is every number of years. And that's based on the work of thousands of scientists. They have a range of likely increase in temperature, and it's based on different emissions trajectories. So it depends on how much we do to our emissions as to what happens to climate change. But the range was from, I think, from 1 point something degrees to 6 degrees by the end of the century. And 2 degrees is what everyone is trying to, what scientists are saying we should limit ourselves to. We shouldn't go above 2 degrees change. So everything is sort of, it's talked about is, well, 0.2 degrees per decade gets you 2 degrees over 100 years, and we need to sort of stop it at that level. A lot of the trajectories have us going above that, and everything that's coming out is worse lately. The second question was... I guess at this stage I'm just frustrated that we don't have anything in Australia. I'll take anything. So I just think that the last... Well, when the Greens were knocking back in the Senate, the CPRS, I just thought that was ludicrous. I mean, I voted Green. I thought, you know, this is a Green thing to be doing, and here they were knocking it back because it wasn't good enough. You know, I didn't really care. Just get it in place. It's sort of a bit like the GSC. Get it in, and then, all right, if you need to tweak it later, tweak it. But you can't do anything if you don't have something in place. So...
I just wanted to add to that that the carbon tax is on all theoretical grounds second best. A trading scheme is the most efficient way to let the market set the price at which carbon will be traded. Is clearly the most efficient way, and it, I agree with Alan. It's frustrating that we've ended up with second best, but it is planned that the carbon tax will only last for something like 5 years, and that we will then transfer to a market. Based setting of carbon price, which is, the carbon tax is much the same as a CPRS, except the government sets the price of carbon, and you know we all know governments are not very good at setting the price of anything, so it's definitely the less efficient way to go.
Going to have to wrap it up there, out of time, but thank you very much for that, Martin and Alan. Could everyone please thank them in the usual way, and then. I'll...